So when I talk to people that are non-tech people, when I start a keynote somewhere in front of a kind of a non-tech audience, I always start with the $105 trillion of world GDP, and 75% of it goes to, through, and with channels of distribution of some type. You bought your last car from a dealer, you bought your last TV from a retailer, you bought your last jar of peanut butter from a grocer. It kind of your entire life works around this method. The agents, the brokers, the franchisees, the retailers, the gas stations, the pharmacies, everything we bump into every day is in an indirect way. The word channel, is shortened for channels of distribution. It is where the money changes hands. The partnership part of it is the broader scope. There is so much work around a customer in an, for example, a considered purchase. And this could be in consumer, like buying a car, or in business, like buying $1 million worth of cybersecurity software. A consumer or business leader will go through 28 moments, definable, measurable moments, before making the purchase.
Welcome to Partnership Plus, your go-to source for modern partnership wisdom with your host, Phil Hayes Sinclair.
So Jay McBain, thank you so much for spending some time with me here on Partnership Plus. You are a renowned, and I will say genuinely, global leader when it comes to partnerships and channels and alliances. Super keen to learn from you today. And I think let's start with the backstory about where you started this journey, because it's been professionally quite a profound one.
Yeah, for me, it dates back now over 30 years. I've had the pleasure and benefit of working in the channel for every day within those 30 years. So learning from every side, from being a channel leader, channel chief at very large companies, growing up in the early days of the managed services industry, was able to go out and build my own piece of software and play the startup role, raising millions and millions of dollars. And then now as an analyst, being able to kind of look at this industry, all $5.4 trillion of it, and connect it to the 193 countries, the 27 industries, obviously the thousands of product categories of what drives partnering, and excited to join.
When people hear partnership or the term partnership or channel for that matter, and they're not in the technology game, often they will be greeted with, what does that mean? How do I make this work? When you think about partnerships and channels, you just mentioned that there is a lot of money flowing through many industries to make this work. How do you define the idea of partnership and channel?
Yeah. So when I talk to, people that are non-tech people, when I start a keynote somewhere in front of a, kind of a non-tech audience, I always start with the $105 trillion of world GDP, and 75% of it goes to, through, and with channels of distribution of some type. You bought your last car from a dealer. You bought your last TV from a retailer. You bought your last jar of peanut butter from a grocer. It kind of your entire life works around this method. The agents, the brokers, the franchisees, the retailers, the gas stations, the pharmacies, everything we bump into every day is in an indirect way. The word channel, is shortened for channels of distribution. It is where the money changes hands. The partnership part of it is the broader scope. There is so much work around a customer in an, for example, a considered purchase. And this could be in consumer, like buying a car, or in business, like buying $1 million worth of cybersecurity software. A consumer or business leader will go through 28 moments, definable, measurable moments, before making the purchase. And in those 28 moments, partners are everywhere. The ebook you read, the podcast like this one you listen to, the event you go to, the consulting gig, the design, the architecture, the configuration, the pricing, the quoting. I could rip through all 28 of them, but the fact of the matter is there's over a 95% chance that those moments are owned by partners and not by you. At the point of transaction, now with digital marketplaces and all different kinds of routes kind of popping up in this new AI era, you know, this is a huge partnering moment, not just for those who collect the money. It might go to AWS on a marketplace, but over half of those deals are going to be funded as private offers, multi-partner offers, distributor sellers of record. So just getting the customer to the dance, getting them on the dance floor, and now in a subscription consumption economy, that's only the first 30 days. Now I need to renew and retain. I need to upsell and cross-sell. I need to enrich. And doing that every 30 days is now the customer for life journey is all partner driven. The average customer now has 7 partners they trust. And the companies that get that, the companies that are building these new platform models, is really synonymous with partnering. So we're having a moment here, not just on channels of distribution, but in all the partnering moments, the 6 or 7 other partners influencing your customer at every stage.
How did you get to love this? It's very obvious that you have a real passion for this, like I do. What were the steps that made you realize this idea of channeling, not going alone, trying to work out the ecosystem, the web of all these transactions, all of those steps you just mentioned before? How did you get here?
Yeah, I got a, well, first of all, you know, when I was, 10 years old or 11, my mom was a computer teacher. Mm-hmm. And this was, late 70s, early 80s. She would lug home an Apple IIe for me in the trunk of her car every day. And if you remember back, these were, 50-pound machines. Mm-hmm. The monitor was a 50-pound device. The printer was 50 pounds. Like, you can imagine my mom doing this for me and allowing me to learn programming and stuff years and years, kind of ahead of my peers. And it started there, but I got an internship out of college at IBM. And, quickly, while I was in the help desk, helping people with their 1-800 calls, I kind of realized the power of partnerships. And what really got me going was entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. I loved hanging around entrepreneurs. And when I looked at IBM and I looked at, those days back then when you couldn't get fired for buying IBM, I really realized in my local town, in my local city, all of the entrepreneurs that made that work. And the people that were turning screwdrivers, the people that were doing those deliveries and customizations, the people that were doing the implementations and the integrations back then. I mean, they were all people that were drafting at the time off of IBM success, but they were becoming millionaires themselves and they were hiring, people like Mad. And I kind of figured out this is kind of the middle class. This is kind of how the economy works. Mm. While we love to watch, Tesla reach new heights yesterday, or we love to watch Amazon or Microsoft or Apple and others that are in the, and now Nvidia at these multi-trillion dollar levels. I love to watch the spinoffs, how you and I could go make $1 million a year by drafting in those, really large ecosystems. Hmm. And that was my passion is, while we all love to watch and the magazines love to run cover stories on, rich billionaires and now, Elon Musk probably becoming a trillionaire this decade. It's fun to watch all the people that can see that opportunity and translate that into, really fast growing, profitable businesses.
When I look back in history, and I consider myself an anthropologist of some kind, when you want to go back and to say, there are ultimately a couple of people sitting around a table wanting to make something great. Instinctively, they knew. They couldn't do it themselves. Mm-hmm. And through a set of conversations, a set of hiccups, and then a set of slow but then very fast progress, IBM gets born or mm-hmm. Amazon comes to life. And we forget about all of the really gritty discomfort that was what a startup was in the first place. You've done it a number of times. I've done it eight times now. And I know what that feeling is like. I feel as though people who are looking at these cover stories of these larger ones forget where that original partnering moment must have happened in order for a company to become something real. If you were to think about going back in history of the partnerships that sort of sit in the back of your mind that either say to you, if we didn't have those conversations, this company wouldn't have been born, or an unlikely company was born as a consequence of these conversations, What are the ones that stick in your mind that you might feel that today we've forgotten about, that if we didn't have them, we wouldn't have what we have today?
Yeah, I mean, if you're a historian, let's dial it way back.
Let's do
it. I'm a Canadian, and one of the oldest companies in the world to be formed was called the Hudson Bay Company. Still exists as a retailer. But they quickly figured out that the fork of every river, you know, provided an opportunity. Back then, the only way of transport was by water. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there was no vehicles, no railroads, no other way of transporting back in the day. So at the kind of the convergence of every river sprout a trading post where, you know, obviously furs and spices and other things could be traded. That's your initial partnership. Mm-hmm. Hudson Bay never made a product. They were not a manufacturer. They didn't mine any products. They didn't create anything other than the opportunity for a 1+1=3 or a better together combination of goods and services to be brought together. And, you know, so there, that dials way back for an anthropologist. But the fact of the matter is the industry that we're in, the industries that we go across, you know, 27 major industries in the world, it is this trade that keeps it going. It's the very bedrock of capitalism. It's the bedrock of economics, demand and supply, and all of the layers around it. So, you know, partnerships, while on one side create unbelievable amounts of wealth, the biggest companies in the world, the ones that are worth the highest values on that global Fortune 500, are all platform partner-specific, partner-friendly, partner-led companies. This is how they create that unbelievable wealth. And then on the flip side, it can destroy wealth. So on the flip side is when I joined IBM, I mentioned that, you know, you couldn't get fired for buying IBM back then, but I also joined a couple of weeks after IBM didn't make payroll. This was the number one stock to own in the 1970s. It was the number one stock to own in the 1980s in terms of growth. It was so big that the government, the US government, started breaking it up in antitrust. And, you know, it was too big and too powerful. But a meeting that happened right where I am here in just north of Miami between a really, really young, disheveled Bill Gates and some IBM executives not only created the richest person in the world on for like the next 15 years, but created a whole different scenario where 20 years ago, 52% of the Fortune 500 no longer exist. 20 years from now, 50% of today's Fortune 500 will not exist. Mm-hmm. If you're not a really big company on that big Fortune list that have the economic power to go and M&A your way to success, it's actually 71% of tech companies, for example, won't exist in 10 years. So if you don't have that capital, if you don't have that large size and staying power, it's even worse of a story. All of this story has a partnerships underpinning to it. The companies today that we're going into this third major 20-year era of compute, moving from client server 1981 through kind of 1999, SaaS in 1999 with the birth of Salesforce, 11 years later, the birth of AWS. But that 20-year cloud cycle has now given way to the AI cycle last March. And we're at the start of a 20-year cycle here, and I can already predict some of the trends that are going to knock off half the companies and their partnership trends.
Let's talk about those, because when I think about the leaders that I coach in this area, there is a significant amount of fear around how they should navigate this, because they do come, you know, they were junior leaders in the late 80s and 90s. They are thinking very carefully about what are the things we've seen before in our past, which we can leverage to try and make decisions to make things sustainable moving forward. What are those trends, do you think, that we're going to see at the end of 10, 15, 20 years time?
Yeah, well, there's a number of them. If you really cut your teeth, you know, in the 80s and 90s, your mentors, you know, the people, silver-haired executives back then that guided you in your early career, were two-tier distribution executives. They understood how to set up a supply chain of how to get product to market, how to choose your routes to market country by country, mm-hmm. how to really drive a product to the end user in a linear way. It involved a whole bunch of incentives. It involved a whole bunch of partner management. You know, you signed up a whole bunch of resellers. But if you started your career a little bit later, this is almost like Malcolm Gladwell outlier type of stuff.
Yep.
If you started your career later, if you happen to be a millennial, you would have joined at a time where, you know, I mentioned Salesforce.com, but ServiceNow and Workday and Marketo and NetSuite and HubSpot and a whole, you know, burgeoning now this year, $420 billion SaaS market kind of got its start. You'll understand that subscriptions don't require resale. They absolutely don't require distribution in the same way because you're distributing bits, not atoms, and you don't need forklifts. And in this world, you know, what was 70 to 80% getting sold through this linear supply chain overnight became 10 to 20. Like Salesforce got to $35 billion, got on the Dow 30, pretty much 99% direct. But if you grew up in this era, you'll realize that Salesforce has 223,000 partners. ServiceNow has 250,000 partners. Mm. And you'd ask, like, how could a direct company who doesn't, you know, issue any of their revenue through third parties grow those kind of partnerships? Well, go back to some of the early Dreamforces and listen to Mark Benioff of how he kicked it off. He called it Ohana, this Hawaiian term for we're all family. But he looked out to an audience of 180,000 people, customers, partners, employees, everybody together, and basically said, you know, for every dollar, back then it was $4.23 of services and other software get created for every dollar of Salesforce. Today, that number is $6.19. It's the multiplier effect.
Yep.
You shouldn't be at Salesforce in a subscription model or a consumption model at AWS, Microsoft, or Google, asking to make 5 or 10 or 20% of the deal. Like you asked, you know, IBM, Compaq, HP, Cisco back in the day for 30, 40% of the deal. You shouldn't be asking those questions because they're the wrong partnership questions. You should be asking us in our QBRs, how do I make $2, $3, or $4 for every dollar of our product? That product has a whole spinoff of services before, during, and after the transaction. There's hundreds of them. The consulting, the design, the implementations, the integrations. I could rip through all, you know, kind of 200 services you could sell. But the partner of the year at these kind of subscription and consumption companies, that next 20-year era, were companies that were selling $3 at 75% margins for every dollar of the product. And these are the partners of the year. They're the ones held up on stage as the heroes. And they don't have any resale business. So again, cutting your teeth in a different partnering moment. Well, guess what? If you're cutting your teeth today, it's a new Gen AI moment. And the pricing model, again, has completely changed. All the agents and that pricing model from Salesforce is no longer a subscription. It's $2 per conversation. That's ServiceNow or Zendesk, it's per outcome or per automated, you know, workflow execution. So it's at a very, you know, transactional microeconomics level, and it's just taking consumption to the next level. So if I learned in two-tier distribution or if I learned in traditional subscription consumption models, those skills now have to be transformed to grow your career in the next 20 years. And keeping your head on the swivel and not sticking to the past is how you get to the top.
I've heard something like that similar recently, and I completely agree. I wonder how a newer leader would look at a large organization. So much of the coaching I do is in an entrepreneurial kind of format where you've got young leaders who are trying to steer a very large traditional ship into that kind of arena. A lot of the incentives and the QBR conversations are focused on those traditional incentives, and it's very difficult to try and find a way through that. And I think it's because many leaders are struggling to work out how to make that shift because economically it means a fundamental reorganization of what's going on. If you were to be sitting in front of those kind of leaders, what kind of guidance would you help them make if they've already got the intention to make that change, but they're fighting against the machine, as it were?
Yeah, well, I, you know, being a student of history, I'll just go back there again. 5 years ago, I stood on the biggest stages in Las Vegas and kind of declared the decade of the ecosystem. You know, we went through a decade of sales, you know, starting kind of in 1999, where any salesperson in the world, and there's obviously hundreds of millions of salespeople in the world, you walked into that decade kind of pre-1999 thinking you were born to be a salesperson. Mm. You manage your, you know, your territory with your gut. It was a beautiful time, you know, where you watch Glengarry, Glenn Ross, you watch Boiler Room. No, this was sales. Well, by the end of the decade, you know, there's probably a much younger revenue leader, rev ops person driving sales as a science with a whole tech stack. You know, 10 years later, we got into the marketing decade. And I remember cocktail parties in 2009 where CMOs would joke around that 50% of their marketing dollars were wasted. They just didn't know which 50%. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, that was really funny in 2009. It got less funny when these CMOs were replaced with 38-year-old growth hackers that were building MarTech stacks with 14,106 MarTech and AdTech tools.
Yep.
By the end of that decade, you know, as we got into 2019, marketing is an absolute science. Anybody who jokes around about losing a dollar of marketing without knowing where it went doesn't have a job.
Correct.
So this is now the decade of ecosystem where you understand that in every marketing moment, in those 28 moments, it's about partnering. And especially at the end of the cookie, we're going through another marketing phase right now where Google and Facebook and others who have built trillions of dollars of value for selling our private data, it's over. So the only way to get to buyer intent and all this early marketing is through partnerships and sharing data with partners who both are, you know, in this, you know, kind of better together mode and are both incentivized to work better together. And in sales, you know, Salesforce did their state of sales report this year, which they do every year. They go and talk to 5,500 of the big CROs and VPs of sales around the world, all industries. And we're at a point now, mid-decade of the ecosystem, where 89% of salespeople are using partners now every day in their sales approach, their ABM strategies and other things. The 11% who are not, 58% plan to within the next 12 months. Mm. You add those two numbers together, you get to kind of 95, 96% of every deal that's partner assisted. These are the seven partners that surround the deal. And a company like Microsoft, for example, is now measuring 96% of their revenue as partner assisted. So this is now this, you know, wonderful sales group who I'm going to say a couple of years ago couldn't spell channel are now using partners every day. The other interesting thing about sales in 2024 is over half the salespeople in the world, hundreds of millions plus people, didn't make their numbers. For those that did, 84% of them point to partners as the reason why. Mm-hmm. It's the new cheat code in sales. So yep. Now that we're midway through this decade of the ecosystem, as partnership professionals, we don't have to shout from the mountaintops anymore. We just heard from HubSpot, it's 84% of now marketing leaders are involving partners in those, you know, first 28 moments. The co-marketing, the co-selling is becoming the new mantra. We're hearing from CX professionals, the same kind of numbers. We're hearing from product leaders that we now have a new buyer at the end of 2024. The majority buyer in the tech industry, for example, 5.4 trillion, is born after 1982. Talk about generations. This is digital first, digital only. They're very subscription consumption friendly, marketplace friendly, but their criteria change from baby boomers and Gen X in that integrations are the most important part of their buying criteria. They'll buy a product 80% as good as the next one if it works better in their environment. 79% of people won't buy a car today unless it has Apple CarPlay or Android Auto, a tech integration. So here we are. This is changing everything. The new buyer. And now as a product leader, I'm not out building, you know, a better mousetrap. I'm trying to build better APIs that I fit together in the 250,000 SaaS companies that are out there or the 1 million emerging tech companies out there. I have to work better in a 7-layer stack around 7 partners who are surrounding that. There's 14 different things I'm concerned about as a product leader, product marketer now, product owner, then I wouldn't have, you know, thought about 5 years ago. So this decade of the ecosystem, we just hit halftime. And now our phones are ringing inbound in terms of asking us for help, in terms of bringing this whole thing together.
That is true. when you think about incentives on that path, you know, there's a lot of money flowing through this system. There are some very traditional incentives that are there, and I find that larger organizations are struggling to work out how to make it worth a partner's while to engage, because of the transactional nature of these kind of API-driven experiences. You can clip the ticket only so far, but what I find, it's not actually the fact that they're trying to put value on the table. It's actually they don't have the systems to deal with that high volume transaction and consumption model. So when they're trying to measure how much, for example, one company should be paid after the first quarter, the second quarter, the first week, they're struggling to work out how to actually tool that to make the numbers work so they can prove that actually, yes, we're happy to pay you for it. We're happy to engage in this model. It's just not working as well as we'd like in our own company.
Yeah, how so incentives is a place that changes radically in this right. new future. Yeah. So if you go back and look at the $105 trillion of world trade, 75% of it moves indirectly. That indirect transaction creates a gross to nets front back end margin conversation. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to say since the start of time, since that Hudson Bay story from 500 years ago, there's been this story of how to divvy up those front and back end margins. And doesn't matter what industry you're in, like what are those market development funds? What are the new customer bonuses? What's the spiff and the rebates? And how do you kind of play in that? And every industry is different, but it could be 10, 20, 30, 40% of revenue that gets traded across the way. But this is radically changing. So I'll go to the tech industry. Microsoft put in a point system 2.5 years ago, and they ripped out all of those gross to nets out of resale. They basically changed their marketplace fees to 3%. They told the world that the value of resale, somebody taking your money, the operations of doing that, somebody taking on the risk that you're not going to pay, somebody taking on the time value of money, net 30, net 60, net 90, which is brutal today with interest rates and inflation, and then taking on, you know, the cost of hiring Biff to break knees when you don't pay. That entire cycle that we thought was 40% in the 80s, 30% in the 90s is now 3. And now as more end customers start to learn that for, through their first 28 moments, they're asking more intelligent questions. If the mechanics of money changing hands is 3%, and that's direct as well, the operational costs and the SG&A costs of taking a customer's money direct is about 3% as well. So it's the entire same economic value of swiping your credit card at a restaurant.
Yep.
Visa or MasterCard take 3% as well. So this whole B2B to B2C thing is collapsing together. But no companies are thinking their gross to nets are going to go from 20 or 30%, you know, in that partnership world down to 3. They understand there might be a 17 or 27% that has to be paid out in different ways. And that's all Microsoft did, is spread out the money like peanut butter. Yep. What if I can measure, like you said, the 28 moments better? What if I can measure every 30 days forever better? Measure that against my cost to acquire a customer, measure that against the customer lifetime value, the things that I'm actually being judged upon by Wall Street. And if I went to tell Wall Street that, hey, you know, we're going to start to measure this and start to incentivize, micro incentivize these moments instead of just paying out, assuming that the person that took the money did all the marketing, selling, engineering to get it. And it was just a 43 year, again, if your skills were built in a previous era, you're just okay without paying out these huge margins to a partner, for example, that did everything. They did all the marketing, the selling, the customer success work. They did the engineering. You won a deal in your sleep. You look in the mirror, you're at 100% club, but you know that, you know, the bluebirds that got you there.
Yep.
That partner is getting paid the exact same amount as the partner that wins an RFP, collects the money, you know, and is gone in the night, that didn't do anything before and doesn't plan to do anything after. Mm-hmm. All they were is the RFP winner because they were $5 less than the competitors. So what, how does it make sense that those two partners make the same amount of money? It just doesn't. And now the industry is waking up to this. Microsoft actually pitched this to Wall Street and said, we think a very sticky subscription consumption led business that has 108% retention, because we know the partners and the 7 partners, and we know how to incentivize them to create these customers for life. We think that that's worth more than a cell phone company that has to come out with a new product every September and sell a lot of it by December.
Mm.
It was 2 years later that the market agreed and Microsoft became more valued than Apple.
Let's jump to my second last question here, because I think the thing that I'm wondering as a consequence of what you've said, and it's been super valuable, thank you. What is the thing that leaders need to be thinking about if they're grappling with this right now? In other words, where are companies going to fall down and look back on it in 2 or 3 years' time and go, I wish we would have made that decision?
Yeah, if the North Star is always your customer, and if I look at that North Star and start to look at the gravity pull around it, you know, that star happens to be a sun that's pulling planets around it. There are 7 trusted partners today around that North Star who's your client. Mm-hmm. You need to be obsessed about who those people are. Whether it's a VAR, MSP, ISV, digital agency, integrator, it doesn't matter who. But whoever earns those spots around your entire market TAM is what you have to be obsessed about. And you're going to find out quickly that you're not measuring that appropriately because you spent 40 years trying to figure out who the reseller is, where the cash register is, not where the circle of influence is. You've also, you know, spent a lot of time, you know, thinking in a very linear way, where if you think across the customer journey, those moments before, during, and after are equally important in a subscription consumption and now the AI era. So my people, my processes, the programs, the underlying technology, everything starts to change when I understand the star that I'm staring at, my customer, and how their behaviors, their psychology, how all of their journey starts to shape, and how much influence is wrapped around it and how that all works. And you'll find out that what got you here is not going to get you there.
Mm. We could talk about this for a very, very long time. Where can people find more about you and your work? I know that you keynote very regularly around some of the largest stages in the world. Where can people find out more about your work?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was just last week I was in Indonesia, you know, kind of talking about this on stage, but yes, crisscrossing, but a good place is always LinkedIn. I write a lot about this on a LinkedIn newsletter. Canalys.com has a lot of the data and some of the numbers that I've mentioned. But breaking down this industry from the very, very top, like the world GDP level down to, you know, how cybersecurity works and partnering and getting and rolling up our sleeves is something we share. And you know, pretty much all of it is outside the firewall in terms of, you know, lifting all boats, you know, as we go through this change and working with you and, you know, the team of experts around the world that actually work to roll up your sleeves and get this stuff executed is the best place to find us.
I appreciate that. Jay, before we get into a rapid fire, I want to put us in the shoes of a 20-year-old university graduate who is, you know, we both have young kids. We're thinking about what the world's going to be like when they leave college. They're still a decade away from maybe that happening, but let's have a think about what they're going to be walking into. How should they be thinking as new college, or even if you're still in college and you're trying to think about, okay, what comes next? Beyond learning how to learn and finding how to read trends and understand where the puck's going to be, what's your advice to them about what they should be thinking about?
Well, first of all, thank you for that Canadian Wayne Gretzky reference. very, very well taken. But I'll tell you that, you know, for example, if you went back 10 or 20 years, you would tell us, you know, coming out of college, that says your role is going to be more of a technology role than you ever believed in any of the courses you took in college. I don't care if you're trying to become a CFO, head of HR, head of operations, head of sales, marketing, product. I mean, any of the vice presidents in any company or work in the government. The fact of the matter is 51% of everyday tasks is going to be around building technology. So you got to be a technologist. Today, I would add to that, your job is going to be wrapped around partnerships. If you're the head of finance, if you're the head of operations, FinOps, for example, is a brand new career just invented in the last few years that now has 24,000 people between the CFO and CIO trying to figure out this edge to cloud and the, you know, economics around it. So I would, you know, like you said, have your head on a swivel, but understand every role will be over 51% technical and over 51% partnerships driven. Building both those skills early in your career will absolutely serve you the best.
Sage advice. All right, let's get into a rapid fire. These are questions I ask every one of our guests here, and I'm very keen to hear what your responses are. So let's dive in. Question one, complete this sentence. Partnership is?
The future.
What content are you loving at the moment? And it can be completely disconnected from business.
I have a hobby that of the tens of millions of people in the industry and channel partnership roles, I ask what they read, where they go, and who they follow. Mm-hmm. And over your shoulder, if you can see me, I've got a whole chart of 1,000 watering holes. Mm-hmm. The top 121 podcasts in the world, like this one, for the 12% of people that's their number one way to get information. The 270 events for the 35% of us who love to go physically and rub shoulders and learn from this and immerse ourselves. But there's 14 different ways that influence us. There's 14 different ways that taught all of us about Gen AI last March when it became a consumer trend. Mm-hmm. And I list them. So if you go to that LinkedIn newsletter, if you go to Canalys, you'll see what shapes this entire world. It's the law of a few, to go back to Malcolm Gladwell again. Mm-hmm. And you'd think that tens of millions of people only learning in about 1,000 places is ridiculous, but that's how it works.
Yeah. I love that. I cannot get enough of learning about this area and how it's evolving. It's so deeply fascinating to me. When you see potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
Well, partnerships always start with an equation. You know, when you look at 1 + 1 = 3, there's not one-sided partnerships. We've grown up with one-sided partnerships where one side kind of gets damaged as one side gets stronger. The very definition of partnerships in the AI era is all boats rise. So you've got to figure out the equation that everybody wins, including, again, your North Star, the customer first wins, and everyone rotating around that star also win.
What's the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
I've received a lot of advice over time. And I'm going to say kind of the worst piece of advice is to kind of stick in your swim lane, you know, stay where you are. You said it earlier, kind of having your head on a swivel, always be learning, always be intellectually curious. The people that succeed, the people that, you know, we watch go into these, you know, really innovative, you know, kind of top roles are looking over, and they would have saw that FinOps thing before anyone else. They would have looked over here and saw kind of the AI shaping. As everybody was dazzled with ChatGPT and a consumer trend, their heads were fully in the $158 billion of B2B opportunity that would come in the first few years. So it's don't stay in your lane. Be intellectually curious every day.
I love it. And final question, what's one thing you're deeply grateful for right now?
Well, going into the holiday season, family. I mean, the industry we're working, which is an extended family. Mm-hmm. And I would say that, you know, I would count kind of millions of people that are all in this kind of partnership game. And we've been disrespected. We've been kind of the redheaded stepchildren. We've been, you know, to use a U.S. actor, the Rodney Dangerfield effect. We get no respect. I mean, now all eyes are on us. And I'm grateful that we're at this point in the decade of the ecosystem. And we can drive the next 5 years into that science that finished those other decades that I mentioned before.
I'm super excited about that. Jamit Bain, thank you for spending the time here. This has been a masterclass, and I'm very much looking forward to our next conversation, whether it be here or in your part of the woods. So thank you so much for the time.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the end of this episode of Partnership Plus. If you like what you heard, you can share this episode via text message. And if you'd like to build your business partnership muscle, my free weekly newsletter called Wednesday Partnership will help you do just that. You'll find a link in the show notes. Finally, I'm big on encouragement and love to see people be in motion towards their ambitions. So if you know someone who might be struggling, reach out to them with a quick message of encouragement. It could change their life. Thanks again, and I'll see you in the next episode.